So a big Zone Show welcome to, I guess I've got to call you a friend of mine now, because we kind of know each other, even though we've never met in person. Joel Freelander, how are you, Joel?
Great, Tom, and it's great to be here.
So I kind of met you through this wonderful thing called social media, didn't I, which is the Twitter sphere.
Yes, we met on Twitter years ago, actually, now. And that's one of the great things about Twitter, isn't it, Tom? Because there's no better way to find people or meet people or introduce yourself to people, I think, than Twitter right now.
Yeah, and I guess it's a zone of its own form, isn't it? It's almost like a consciousness zone for the planet. If you tune into the Twitter stream, you kind of get to know what the planet is thinking.
It's very much like the nervous system of the worldwide mind, in a sense. I mean, you can't possibly pay attention to everything happening at once, but you can certainly dip in real time and find out lots of things that are going on. But I like the way it allows us to connect in a much more fluid way. I mean, it's really the new world. I mean, I've connected with many people on Twitter who probably would not have taken my phone call. But we met and interacted and established a great relationship on Twitter, and I continue to do that to this day.
Yeah, well, I got a book deal from one tweet.
Okay.
I put a tweet out which has nothing to do with the book I was writing, and this guy said, "Oh, I like the blog that your tweet referred to," and I said, "Oh, I've just finished a book. Would you be interested in publishing it?" And he said, "I sent the PDF rough copy over." And within 24 hours, I had a book publishing deal. So it's got real business applications, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's to me, it reminds me a little bit of like the electric service. You know, they run the electricity to your house, but what you plug into it is up to you. It's simply a service. You know, and Twitter, to me, is very much like that. There's not very much there. I mean, it's just text messages in real time. I mean, that's really all it is. With links. And so how you choose to use it is up to you. And it's just like a utility. For instance, a lot of people use it for letting people know about the stuff they're working on or stuff they've written or just published. I know I do that a lot. I like to share links on Twitter. And Twitter is probably the second biggest traffic source on my blog.
That's interesting, because you're in one of my lists. You may not know this. I've got a list called Writer's Friends.
Oh.
And so all I do is I plug the people in that I consider to be the real writer's friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though we haven't spoken for a while, I kind of know what you've been up to. I know you've got some new products and services out. I know the sort of things that you've been working on, the blogs you've been posting and this sort of stuff. So we can keep it. I'm not lurking and stalking you, but we can keep an eye on each other, which is great. So, and the reason I think you're a great writer's friend is that you have a real skill, and that's book design in the widest terms. And I'm kind of curious, because I kind of potter with my own designs. I use a bit of stock imagery and this sort of stuff. But I don't consider myself a designer. I'm more being expedient and having fun, really. So I'm experimenting with book covers. But you are what I'd consider a professional book cover designer. So if I was to approach you with the inner of a book, which has got the words, you know, pretty much there, how would you go about that design process?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, a book cover has so many jobs it has to do. And yet it's a fairly small, piece of real estate. Even if it's a paperback cover, you've got about 50 square inches. And then online, of course, we have much less than that. We have those little JPEGs that have to stand in for the covers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you think about it, the cover of a book has to immediately, instantly, and almost subconsciously let you know what kind of book it is. What genre generally it's in. You know, if you're looking for thrillers and it looks like a romance, you're going to go right past it. And that's one of the jobs of the book cover. You know, and if I'm looking for romance readers, I want to tell all those thriller people to just keep going, because this is not of interest to them. And so then it has to interest us. It has to have some kind of hook. You know, I mean, if there's nothing there that's exciting or intriguing or delightful, you know, it just kind of lays there and doesn't do anything. So I approach book cover design for novels, for fiction, and for nonfiction very differently. For nonfiction books, I don't actually have to read the whole book in order to design the cover, because nonfiction books make it very explicit what their subject matter is. And that's really what's most important. You know, we're selling information or history or memoir or something that can be quite easily defined, like, you know, a new system for producing materials or, you know, a history book. These things are quite obvious, and we know how to design covers because those covers are going to appeal to the people interested in that specific topic. So I have a book about, you know, swimming pools. I know exactly how to design that because there are only certain people who are going to buy that book or even be interested in it. Now, for fiction, you really have to read the book or read a good deal of it because one of the things the cover has to embody is the tone of the book, and the, you know, the kind of the style of the writer should be implied somehow in the cover and the artwork or the design or something like that. Now, once you have some kind of idea of who your ideal reader is, because that's who you're aiming for with the cover, then you have to just start exploring, and that is probably the most fun part of the creative process, when you have that blank screen or blank piece of paper and all possibilities lie in front of you, and you haven't yet started to whittle them down, you know, which is completely a process of elimination. And so when we're just kind of noodling or you know, fooling around, sometimes designers look like they're not really working because they're twiddling, they're tweaking, they're you know, when I had my design studio in New York Town years ago, I, like every other graphic designer, had what we called a swipe file. And the swipe file was where if you were reading a magazine and you saw a little border or a way of using type or maybe some colors that went together nicely, you saw that, you'd tear that out and throw it in your swipe file. And I had a drawer full of this stuff.
And have you got a digital equivalent of that now?
Well, I do. I capture things regularly. It's a little bit easier to capture them because I just use screenshots now instead of tearing out pages from magazines. But yes, I absolutely do. And I also use my camera quite a bit, more than I used to because it's so much easier. We all have our camera with us all the time now. So if I see a design detail, now I may have no idea why I like that or why I like those colors or what it is, but I just grab it because it caught my eye. Now, when I go to sit down and design something and I'm sitting there and thinking, well, I don't have a clue what I'm going to do here. You know, frequently I'll go into the swipe file and you just start looking at stuff and, you know, your mind somehow starts to work on it from another place, a non-conscious source. And you start pulling things out and putting things together and experimenting. And it's almost like an art class, but it's even less structured than that. And something will click. You know, you'll put the title down and some colors will suggest themselves or an image, and you start moving it around. And the next thing you know, you're in the zone and you've produced, you know, maybe 10 or 12 or 15 different designs. They just start flowing out of you. And whether you're using that stuff from the swipe file or not. And I think part of the what happens there, Tom, is that, you know, just the act of suppressing your own thought process and just being open to, you know, the colors, textures, designs, and stuff in front of me starts to work in a less than conscious manner to produce this this creativity that comes out. That's not a step-by-step recipe for doing design, by the way. That's more of an internal monologue of what's going on inside me when I'm sitting there looking at stuff that I need to design.
Or maybe a non-monologue, because your internal mind chatter has gone down to zero. So in these days then, when we got things like Kindles that are black and white, and we got iPads, and we got a physical book still. And obviously in the US you're slightly ahead of us over in the UK, so I know that ebook sales, we're always tracking behind you, but I guess they're what, 70, 60, 70% now of book sales.
The ebook sales have not taken over that much of the market yet, to be honest. I think of total book sales, ebooks are really about 25%.
Oh, is that all? So, but even at that 25% and it's growing, how important is it to find a cover that works on all the formats, or do you design differently for the different formats?
Well, that's a really interesting question, Tom. You've touched a kind of a sensitive point for me because for several years I've been trying to convince cover designers to tackle these chores separately. In other words, to design, if you got a book that's going to be both a print book and an e-book, let's design the print book first. You know, that we have a much bigger space, we have much more data we can put in there. We could do things with textures and finishes and stamping and foiling and all these different things that we can do to create a really interesting or impressive or attention-grabbing cover, depending on what you need. Now, the ebook cover, of course, is com a complete metaphor. There's not covering anything. There's nothing to cover. All we're talking about is two different files, right? So we've now moved into a metaphoric version of something that actually exists in the real world. And the ebook cover is going to be a small JPEG, a little graphic file. And my approach to this, Tom, is to take whatever branding, colors, typography, the whole look of the print book cover, and then translate them, simplify them, and reduce it for the ebook cover. So I think they really You're better served, unless you have a design that really translates very well to re being reduced, by actually reinterpreting the cover. Now, your finished product on the ebook cover and the print book cover, it should be obvious that they're the exact same book. But that doesn't mean the cover is just going to be, well, let's just shrink that baby down. That doesn't usually work very well for ebooks. Unfortunately, it's been slow going, Tom, but I'm working this pretty hard.
And you're like the vanguard. You're shining the torch for all designers out there.
I'm like an evangelist on this subject because I don't see any reason why, maybe the designers are afraid people won't pay them for the work. I don't know. But it's really not, it's actually quite good fun. I mean, really, what we want to do is we want to remove elements that become irrational at a small size. In other words, if you have a little quote at the top of your book cover, maybe you got a blurb from somebody in your field or an early reader, and that's really nice to have. But if you have a little quote set in like 12-point type at the top of the book, when you reduce that down to something that's about an inch high, in my mind, it becomes irrational because you can no longer read it. So why is it there? There's no reason for it to be there. It'd be far better to take it off, to use the space, to unclutter the space, so you have less noise and your signal can be heard more clearly. So if you have to make the title typography bigger in relationship to the overall space, then do that. Get rid of the stuff that doesn't work, simplify it, and you'll have a much better effect on an ebook cover. And still, with any kind of talented designer, you'll be able to see right away that you're looking at the same book cover, even though they're in different versions.
My background, as you know, is in broadcasting. I remember in the studio, we used to have a speaker from a car radio. We had standard speakers from home. Then we had the big professional monitors. And before anything went out, we used to listen to the program on all the output formats where people would actually listen and watch it. And we'd also have a black and white telly in those days, a color telly, which was overscanned, so you missed the edges, and then the professional broadcast monitors. And I guess that publishing now, it's kind of caught up with audio production and video production. The same rules kind of apply.
Yeah, absolutely. And the proliferation of these different formats is a challenge, but it's a good challenge. I mean, the ebook is not going away. It's going to become more and more ubiquitous. It's going to become more useful. Obviously, they're also going to become better looking and more open to the control of the designer, which they're not right now very much, as time goes by. So they will get better and better. And I think this is a time when we can really influence some of the direction of how that eventually unfolds. And that's why I'm really interested in seeing designers take on this challenge of really reinterpreting their print book cover designs, which are fantastic. We have great cover designers, and reinterpreting them for the ebooks and the whole digital field, you know, because even if you have a print book, if the only place it's available is online, that means that your cover has to be, you know, suitable for discovery online and do all those same jobs. Even though it may only be an inch high on your screen, it still has to tell you what kind of book it is, give you some idea of the tone, and maybe the author's name needs to be prominent because you've got a well-known author. Whatever it is, it still has to do the same jobs. And of course, we want to get the click. We need people to click that title or the cover so they can, you know, continue in their process of learning about our book.
I think we'll throw an official zone show gauntlet down then about cover design and having different designs for different formats. So I'm going to play a bit of music now, Joel, and we'll come back and talk about the inside of the book. And that's a very hypnotic, moving, and haunting track called To the Beach from the album of the same name by the most amazing pianist and composer Sam Joseph, who I'm delighted to say will be on the show shortly, sharing his experiences of how he gets in and stays in the zone. Today I'm speaking to designer extraordinaire Joel Freelander. Hi again, Joel.
Hi, Tom.
So we've just been talking about exterior book design. So that would be for a print book, that would be the front cover and the back blurb. Back blurb in ebooks doesn't really exist. It's this metaphor as we're talking about. But the interior book design is something I've always dabbled with, but I've never called myself a professional at it till recently, until I downloaded one of your excellent templates, which it showed me not only how to do it, it showed me all the things I've been doing wrong, which is kind of interesting. So that was a great education for me. But to me, interior design, it looks nothing. You know when it's wrong. But if you're a naive person like me that hasn't been taught about design, you don't know what how to do it right. So how do you approach the whole theme of interior design, again, based on what the book's trying to say?
Yeah, this is an interesting topic for me, Tom, because books are very pedestrian in a sense. They are commonplace objects. We've gotten used to them from the time we were even before we could read, because most of us had parents who would read to us. So the book has been with us most of our conscious life, and we just take them for granted, and they just seem dead simple. I mean, just words on a page. I had a client to me say to me once a couple of years ago, he said, "Book designer." He said, "Well, what do? You just put the page numbers on, right?" I said, "Well, yeah, it's a little bit more than that." But book design has evolved over about a period of about 500 years. We've become very expert in presenting long documents to readers in a way that makes them enjoyable and delightful to read, and where the author's message can travel unencumbered to the mind of the reader. And that is really what interior book design is about. I mean, we worship at the altar of the author's ideas, because that's really the whole reason for the book to exist. So really what we're looking for is typefaces that are easy to read and appropriate for the use they're being put to. We look to page layouts that suit the our human habits of how we like to read, and that has a lot to do with how long the lines are, so that you don't get lost in the book. I don't know if you've ever noticed that, Tom, but if you ever see something, and you see this on the web a lot, that's been typeset with very long lines, it's extremely fatiguing to read. Plus, you have this problem of doubling where you have to get to the end of the line and go all the way back, and it's very easy to lose your place and not know which line you're on. So the actual length of the line is something that book designers are very concerned about, the space between the lines, all of these kind of minuscule details that nobody would ever give much thought to come into play. And along with that, because books are, basically just page after page of type, we have a big respect for how to use negative space. And that's just a design term for the place where you haven't put anything. It's just, there's nothing there. And that negative space is really important. For instance, if you look at most books, you'll see at the beginning of a chapter, there's going to be a deep drop on the page. Maybe a third or a half of the page will be left almost blank. Maybe just the title or the number of the chapter and nothing else. And that's really there to create rhythm and relief for the reader. So that there's a sense, there's a rhythmic feeling. You finish the chapter, and then there's a space there before you start the new chapter, and that has a certain kind of beat to it. And then also, just the empty space gives us a little relief. We know, okay, this is time to stop. We kind of breathe out, and get ready for the next subject, which is going to be represented by the next chapter. We also use a lot of navigational aids, because if you're right in the middle of a 300 or 400 page book, let's say on the history of the early United States colonialism, and you want to remember where you are in the book, so we have things like what we call running heads, where at the top of the page we'll tell you the exact section of the book you're in, what that section is about, and even down to the point where when we design books that are arranged alphabetically, like a dictionary, an encyclopedia, a glossary, a history of place names, any kind of book like that, where we actually put in the running heads, the terms that you'll find on those pages, so that a reader can flip through quite quickly and see exactly which page they want to interact with at that moment, depending on what information they're looking for. So all of these things come into play, as well as physical things like the property of the paper you're using, the way the book is bound, which has a lot to do with how flexible it is, what it's like to hold the book, if you try to lay it flat, what happens then, the kind of binding in terms of whether it's a soft cover or hard cover, and how that influences the reader's experience. All of these things come into play in the design of this very, very ordinary object.
So not just putting numbers at the bottom of every page. So same question again then. So now we've got these e-readers that have got, some of them have got pretty basic formatting. Some of them have got other abilities with formatting with style sheets and things like that. Do you have to have now two versions of the book, one that works in print and one that works well on e-readers?
Yeah, and this is something we confronted with our template business. You mentioned the templates, and you know, just to be more explicit about that, you know, I have a site where we sell templates for people who want to publish their own books. It's called bookdesigntemplates.com. And right now we're doing Word templates, and what we found was that because we had to strip out so many of the elements that were in the print book for the ebook. For instance, in an ebook, you don't have any page numbers, running heads, or stuff like that. They just don't exist. They would be kind of illogical in an ebook. There wasn't any easy way to create one file that would produce both books. So what we did was we actually created templates separately for our print books, and then we incorporated that same design into a simplified, stripped-down ebook template. So unfortunately, the state of our technology right now, you do actually have to do the book twice if you're doing it yourself, once for print and once for the ebook. You can maintain some of the design, but of course that's also at the at the convenience of the reader, because as we all know, once you have that Kindle in your hand, you can just change the look and feel of the book instantly just by changing the typeface or the size or background color or something like that.
You mentioned these book design templates allow non-experienced designers to do their own designs, but obviously with an MS Word template, the ability to mess it up is incalculable, let's say. What tips would you give to somebody that is kind of new to this, that want to use a template to lay out their book? How would they go about it?
Well, you know, part of the virtue of the Word template version, doing a book in a Word template, that's actually turned out, and I didn't expect this, Tom, when we started this out. I just wanted to give people a way to do these books better and make them look better and be standard constructions, so they weren't, you know, because there's a lot of weirdness you find in self-published books of people who haven't bothered to find out how books are supposed to be made. But one of the benefits is that, you know, the book is editable. Most people have a copy of Microsoft Word. So if you decide 3 months from now that you really want to rewrite Chapter 7, you could just open up that Word document and rewrite Chapter 7. As far as your question about tips on doing the using templates, you know, I think the best thing is to make sure that you thoroughly understand our formatting guide. Every, you know, when you get a template from our site or wherever, I mean, we provide a very extensive illustrated formatting guide that you can follow step by step, and it takes you through the process of putting your own text into the template and styling it, and so your book is going to come out looking great.
It does. Well, you know, The Zone was done using that, one of the templates.
And I think it looks fantastic. You did a great job, Tom. And I think it was interesting the way you actually modified the template for your own needs by putting in the whole Zone logo in the chapter headers. And I hope that wasn't too difficult a task for you. But it just goes to show how the template is kind of, you know, you can use it as it is, or you can modify it to suit your purposes.
And as you know, I used Apple Pages, not MS Word. So I've always been one to never follow the rules. So.
Yeah, well, I just saw a book that a woman did with one of our templates that had over 200 illustrations in it. And, of course, the templates weren't quite set up to be picture books, but she, you know, she just modified it to suit the material that she had, and it worked beautifully, and the book came out great.
On that note, I thought I'd just tell you how I did The Zone, because it's kind of important, I think, for to share with the readers, because I had this theory with The Zone. I had enough time to do it slightly differently. Is I did the ebook version first, put it out there to get some user feedback, to make sure I hadn't lost people. And then I did an audiobook version. And I had it proofread before the ebook version went out there. But when I did the audiobook version, I found that if I couldn't read something out loud, there was a pretty good chance the readers wouldn't be able to read it in loud. And it was only after I went through that editing process that I'd go and move it into the print book. And then when you now, and then I went and modified the ebook version as well. So it wasn't typos so much as at this point, just how I'd said things. And then I found after take three, I couldn't say the sentence. I thought it was about time to rewrite that particular sentence.
That's fascinating, and I could see how that would be a really good method. You know, I mean, writers have used the technique of reading their work aloud for many years, forever, you know, to see how it sounds. But I think you've taken that to a new level, and I bet the book is a much better read because of the work you put in doing that.
Well, as this is radio and we can play, why don't we share a little bit of that audiobook version of The Zone? And then we'll come back and I want to talk to you about your fantastically wide experience of independent publishing. How's that sound?
Lovely.
Chapter 6, The Creative Zone. While the live performer has the advantage of that adrenaline rush to push them to new heights, for the most part, the creative performer works offline on their art, their music, or their words. The motivation for writing that book or composing that new song can prove elusive. Artists all too often find their creative juices run dry. An external deadline, or perhaps an author's advance, can provide an incentive, but it can also be a curse. When we're in flow, however, it's almost like we've been taken over by an external force, and we're just an agent and co-collaborator in the creative process. Time takes on an ethereal quality, and whatever we produce can be near perfect first time around. It may be becoming clear that the boundaries between the zones is not hard or even fixed. Creatives need to be masters of the time zones. Any artist should be superbly creative about hopping round the zones, including some of the danger zones. Entrepreneurs and performers need to be comfortable in the creative zone. All of them will want to get their audience and customers into the happy zone, and to keep them there. As a self-serving example, the very writing of this book requires me to enter the mindset of people in each of these zones. The key to managing the creative process is to recognize that there is not one zone but several. Anyone involved with a creative task has to work through a number of steps to ensure their work gets finished. If they are in the wrong mode at the wrong time, their work can end up on a slush pile of their own making. Any half-written manuscript or part-completed canvas is a sign that the creative process has hit a roadblock at one of the subzones. Indeed, before even embarking on a piece of work, we need to have entrepreneurial vision to be able to see it through and the persistence of a live performer to make it happen. Again, this indicates how zones cross-fertilize each other. So welcome back to The Zone Show. I hope you enjoyed that little snippet from the audiobook version. And we're talking again to Joel Freelander. And we met through social media, Joel. But you are adept, I think, and very expert in how to use social media to promote your book. What would you say would be the key for an author in doing that? And where, you know, when you've got to write the book and get the cover design and the interior cover laid out and this sort of stuff, where in the process should a new author start with their social media experience and journey?
That's really an excellent question, Tom. And the answer to that question is it can be very dispiriting to indie authors. But here's the thing. You know, several years ago, the online marketing guru, Seth Godin, was asked, you know, when should I start promoting my book? And he said 3 years before your publication date. And that's usually something that when I recount this story, it usually makes people's heads get very hot and bothered. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that social media has put into our hands the most incredible marketing capacity the world has ever seen. And one of the reasons for that is not just because there's so many people using it. That's not really where the big impact is. The big impact is that you can actually find the people who are interested in your specific subject because there's so many people online. you can actually work out ways to find and bring them to a site where you're talking about that subject, let's say. So and that to me is the essence of social media. When there's an interaction possible, then you have the social element. So for instance, I like typography and talking about fonts and book design and stuff like that. But before social media, it was very hard to find people who wanted to talk about that stuff. And my wife wore out many years ago. She doesn't want to talk about fonts anymore. And but when I started my blog, Tom, back in the end of 2009, I thought, it's going to be very interesting to see who I can find online who would like to talk about this stuff, because that's what I'm interested in. That's what I'm passionate about. That's what I do for my work every day. And so that's naturally what I'm kind of interested in connecting to people about. So as an indie author, because I write books about this subject also, I face the same problem that all other indie authors face. And that is, how do I find my readers? Or, looked at the other way, how will my readers find me? How will they even know that this book exists? And social media answers that question in a more powerful and targeted way than we have ever been able to answer it before. So for me, learning a little bit about how search engines work, what kind of content they like, learning to write for the web, where we write really a little differently than we do for other media, and learning how to get my stuff out there so people knew it was out there had really, really worked. So I started to acquire an audience of people who are interested in the stuff I'm interested in. That is like book design and how you market your books and how you publish them. And this to me, Tom, is the essence of marketing. A lot of authors say to me, geez, Joel, don't start talking about marketing. I don't want to have to sell my book. And I tell them, like, wait a second, we're not talking about making sales. Selling is a transaction. I give you $10, you hand me the book. We've made a transaction. That's not what marketing is about. Marketing is about communicating your passion for what you're doing with other people who share that interest. Hey, come on. That's fun. That's not hard. So, realistically, the best way for indie authors to market their stuff is to study the tools, the digital tools we have now, and find out how they can help you locate your ideal readers. Where are they? What are they talking about? And get into the conversation. If you have something valuable to say, you will soon have plenty of people very interested and willing to listen to what you have to say, to get into a conversation with you, to engage with you, maybe to get on your email list. And eventually, these people are going to turn into your book buyers.
But you've got Twitter, you've got Facebook, we've got Google Plus, we've got Goodreads, we've got Library Thing, we've got all of these places where these readers might be hanging out. And like, if let's say these were all English pubs, right? You can only be in one pub at a time, and if you're
That's right.
in the wrong pub at the wrong time, you could miss everyone. If you start running around chasing around all the pubs, you might just be missing your readers by one, by an hour or so. So where are the best places to hang out, and what are the best practices to do when you hang out? You don't run into the pub and say, "Hey, buy my book."
No, because that's the transactional thing, like give me $10 and I'll give you the book. And really, we want to avoid that, basically, as authors. That's not really for us. I mean, if we're going to be much better off if we leave that to the retailers. That's a retail operation, that kind of transaction stuff. What we want to do is not only locate our readers, but get them excited about what we're doing. Now, Tom, as you know, I'm a committed blogger. I find the blog the best tool for me personally and for my subject. And I think that any nonfiction author would be doing themselves a real disservice if they don't at least spend some time understanding how a blog works and learning to write for one. I mean, you can have a very realistic blog that actually attracts people and does lots of other things for you, even by just posting a couple of times a month. If you have really good content, Look, I get monthly magazines, and when the day that magazine arrives, I jump all over it. I want to read every article in there. I'm really excited, So the frequency isn't so important. Sometimes people get hung up on that, and they think, well, if I'm not blogging every day, then it's not worth it. But that is very far from the truth.
Would you start with a blog and then use the other platforms like Twitter and Facebook then to disseminate the word out there about the blog?
What I do, Tom, is I use what I call the hub and outpost method of social media marketing. So my hub, and different people's hub can be different. Some people use YouTube, some people use Facebook. I think a blog is the best thing, or a website, because you can actually own it. You can't get thrown off if you like somehow, violate the terms of service or something. You can't get yanked. We don't want to end up being digital sharecroppers. We're doing all the work and a man owns the property. That's not good. So what we do is I have a blog. I have the blog gives me a way to get into more detailed conversations with people. I can make them offers on my blog, like sign up for my email list. I'm going to give you this great PDF that's going to tell you about all these dangers of self-publishing you can avoid. Just, download it. It's free. I can run contests. I could do so many things on my blog. So that's my hub. And then I go out from there and I say, okay, well, where is a good place to put an outpost? So for me, Twitter is a great place to use as an outpost. So I have an account there. But what I'm really trying to do is to get the people I encounter on Twitter to come and visit my blog, where I can interact with them in a much richer environment and meet more of my goals, and also give them much more value than I can strictly on Twitter or Facebook. On Facebook, it might be hard for me to give them a 30-page PDF and have them sign up for an email list. That's easy to do on my blog. So what I'm going to do is at each of these outposts is use them as places to interact with people who share my interests. And after all, that's, I'm not broadcasting. We're sharing. We're having a conversation. So I might go to Goodreads, let's say, and go into the self-publishing group on Goodreads and have conversations there. And while I'm doing that, I'm going to have a link in my signature line or wherever it is, so that people, if they're interested in what I have to say, or they think, gee, I'd like to find out more about what Joel's talking about, they can click that link and go back to my blog, where I've got all the resources and the richness and the engagement, and of course that email list, which is super, super, super important to me as a business person. And so each of these output, and you can just do one at a time. You don't have to overwhelm yourself. It's crazy when people go out and they start opening accounts everywhere because they think, I got to be everywhere. Like, I got to be on Shelfari and Wattpad and Goodreads and Library Thing. And then, of course, that doesn't bode well for your future sanity, because you will burn out doing it that way. In my method, we establish our hub, and then we pick one outpost, we develop that, we really dive into it, we understand the richness, how it works, where the people are, and then once we've done that, we move on to another one.
That's a fantastic strategy. And of course, there's loads of places, aren't there? Because look, for you as a book designer, you can post stuff on Pinterest and
Sure.
get people repinning stuff. It's amazing the number of people that seem to pick up images. And I use Pinterest when I generate an image. It goes up there. When I generate some audio, it goes on one of my podcasting channels. When I generate some text, there's a great site called Twimagination. Have you heard of that one?
No, that's a new one to me.
It's called Twimagination, and if you've got longer than 140 characters, so let's say you've got some chapters of a book you want to sample or some poetry, you shove it on there, that they immediately add it to your Twitter feed, and the people click on it and they can see the full body text, and they always retweet you.
That's lovely. I'm going to look into that.
Absolutely. And they retweet you to people that like reading that sort of poetry or that kind of short story material, which is a great. I use that a lot when I'm developing a theme, and I might just put a couple of chapters out, just get a feeler for what people think about it. So there's no shortages of these outposts, really, are there?
No. And the fact of the matter is, we keep talking about the same ones, but that, like Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest. But the fact of the matter is that there are many, many smaller social sites that are frequently much better for individual authors. You know, for instance, there are sites where I can go and just talk about typography with other people. And, you know, most people have never heard of these sites. There's, you know, bunches of little social sites using that Ning platform where you can set up your own social media site in like 5 minutes. And the fact of the matter, you know, there's also forums, discussion groups. Like if you're writing about food and cooking, you know, there's this great site called eGullet, which is fantastic. Yeah, it's a great site. It's populated by thousands and thousands of serious foodies, professional cooks, professional bakers, people who run restaurants. You know, the profile range of the people on there is just phenomenal. Now, you're never going to hear somebody reference eGullet as a good social media place, but if you're writing cookbooks or how-tos about food or how to build brick ovens or anything like that, this is a fantastic place to find other people and to do the same kind of outpost building that I was talking about before.
So where is your hub, Joel?
My hub is at my blog, which is at thebookdesigner.com, thebookdesigner.com. And, you know, that's the center for all my activities. And I'm building out other sites now, like my template site, bookdesigntemplates.com. But everything, you know, I use my blog as the hub, and that's where I've built my email list and my readership. And, you know, I now, after having worked on this for several years, Tom, I have a pretty active community there. And the benefits to me as an indie author are just staggering. Like, for instance, if I want to know if a book concept is a good idea, like, you know, I might think it's a good idea, but is anybody else interested? You know, I'm not sure, right, until I float it out there. But I have so many people reading my blog now, I can quickly get feedback, for instance. Last year, I did a poll on topics people would like to hear, would go to a webinar on. And I made up a list of 9 topics. And, you know, I was a little surprised at the results of the poll, but I had over 600 or 700 responses. So it was a pretty good poll, really. You know, like some of my favorite topics were right at the bottom of the list. Nobody wanted to hear about them. So, you know, it's not that we need the crowd to tell us what to do, but it's more that we're in an endless conversation with our own readers. And that has unbelievable benefits in terms of raw market intelligence that it's very hard to get any other way.
And so whether you've got a traditional publishing deal or you're an indie author, these principles still apply, don't they, for both?
Absolutely. And, you know, as you know, I mean, the traditional publishers have been pushing more and more of the book marketing and promotion onto the authors. Mm. And I just went through this. I just did a seminar at a writers' conference here in California about book launches and how you organize your assets and get them all moving in the same direction for when you launch a book. And I would say half of the people in the seminar were traditionally published authors because they know they need to understand this stuff now. You know, the publisher isn't going to do everything for you anymore, even if they ever did. I think that was mostly, you know, a fable anyway. So, yeah, all authors, you know, except maybe the very, very top tier, you know, the Grishams and the Rowlings. I mean, the rest, every other author really needs to understand this stuff and to know how to use it to their benefit. And you know, the thing is, once you get into it, Tom, it's quite good fun. You meet people like Tom Evans.
Well, listen, you are the absolute fount of fantastically useful information, as well as being a very accomplished artist and creative. But I can't let you go from the Zone Show before you answer one question, and it's simply this. How does Joel Freelander get in the zone?
How do I get in the zone? Well, I'm very lucky, Tom, because before I started blogging, I spent 2 years doing a practice called free writing. And free writing is where you set a timer and you have a prompt. And I do it freehand. I don't type. But you then start writing and you write as fast as you can until the timer goes off and you don't stop. And after doing that for several years, I really kind of trained myself to be able to drop into the zone almost any time I want. Because this practice, because it kind of goes around your conscious mind, it taps into that tremendous stream of creativity that is always running. It's always there. It's like an underground stream, you know, and we're walking around doing our stuff. But when you drop down, it's always there and you can connect to it if you train yourself anytime you want. And the secret to doing that, of course, is to get out of your own way. You know, you have the reason you have to write fast is because you have to get faster than your brain. You have to go so fast that you don't actually know what you're going to write next. You have no idea what's going to come out. And for me, that puts me right in the zone.
And you do that every day?
I used to do it every day. I don't anymore since I started blogging. I get so much writing I do. But it's really, really satisfying. It connects you to like an elemental source of creativity that's inside you and that's inexhaustible and constantly surprising.
Well, Joel, you're always constantly surprising to me because we start off on a particular theme and we've been talking about conventional things like cover design, and then you've left us with that fantastic gem. So thank you for sharing that with us, and I hope this is not the last time you come on the Zone Show.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Tom. I always enjoy our conversations, even though I don't know where they're going. And I just want to thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Joel.